G'day, everyone. Quick message before we start. What we're trying to do with this podcast is to help people better understand their mind and how it works and give people practical strategies they can use to maintain and improve their mental health. Would you consider helping us to continue to do that with a financial contribution, large or small? If so, thank you. Just follow the link in the show notes. All donations $2 or more are tax deductible. G'day, welcome to Minding Your Mind. Our podcast is all about your mind and about how it works and mental health and mental illness. I'm with Professor Ian Hickey, psychiatrist and co-director of the Brain and Mind Centre at the University of Sydney. What are the costs of poor mental health? Foremost, of course, is the cost in human suffering. Also, there are economic costs for individuals, medical costs, seeing a GP, a therapist, buying medication, maybe blood tests. You might miss work, you might miss study, delaying your entry into the workforce. For young people, the economic impact may fall on their family. That could cause tension within the family. The young person might feel guilty about it. Family members and carers might also miss work. And what about for society as a whole? Poor mental health has an enormous cost. Hard to quantify, but in 2020, the Productivity Commission gave it a go and estimated that in 2018-19, that year, the annual cost to the economy, the Australian economy, of mental ill health and suicide was up to $70 billion. So direct expenditure on mental health care and support services, around $16 billion. The annual cost of lower economic participation and lost productivity, up to $39 billion. The cost of replacing the support provided by carers of those with mental illness was about $15 billion. That's $70 billion. In addition to that, they estimated the cost of disability and premature death due to mental illness, suicide and self-inflicted injury. How do you put a price on that? Well, they did. They estimated it as equivalent to a further $151 billion per year. Plus, there's the social and emotional costs of lower social participation or stigma associated with mental ill health as well. So how do we manage these costs? What can we do to reduce them, both for the individual, the family or the group, and society in general? Ian, can we start with individuals? Having a mental illness or having poor mental health, it can be really expensive.
It's expensive. And can I start, James, by apologising to the listeners? For those who might have thought tuned in the wrong podcast, yeah, the economics one or the political one, to apologise for having spent a good deal of the last 25 years of my life in the public domain trying to put a cost on human suffering.
Yeah.
And costing people's lives.
How you persuade decision makers,
right?
Isn't it?
So why I personally have been involved in this for a very long time and was part of the National Mental Health Commission, which made the recommendation to the Prime Minister and the Treasurer, and then the Treasurer, the Prime Minister was Malcolm Turnbull, the Treasurer was Scott Morrison, to refer this matter to the Productivity Commission to produce that marvellous list of figures that you just came up with. Because unless we talk about the economic cost, and therefore why we would spend money, why we would invest new monies in trying to fix it, people tend to pat you on the head and say, that's very sad and please carry on. And I wish, hope I don't end up in the same situation myself, but I don't believe it's worth the investment.
Exactly.
Like bridges or railways or airports or stuff that we spend money on to drive productivity.
Exactly.
To actually increase the national wealth.
And this is across all industries. If you can go to a decision maker, and this works in businesses too and probably in your family, if you can say, look, I want you to make this change, and if you do, over 5 years, it will save you money. It will cost this, but you'll get back this plus a bit more. You are well on the way to convincing that decision maker. So if you can say, look, this is the cost of poor mental health in the community. If you spend some money to fix it, you'll make your money back really quickly. That's what you're trying to do, right?
Absolutely. And there is this thing in government, for those who don't obviously know the obvious, government's run by the so-called core portfolios, Treasury, Finance, Prime Minister, Premier. The rest are all people who spend the money.
Yeah.
They're all, and we in the human services sector health, education, social services. We're seen as big spenders. We're seen as people who just like to spend money without considering the value, what's to be gained economically, as well as the human cost of that. So those people sit in those portfolios, and let's face it, they run government, they run the decision making, because they try to say it's like your own credit card, it's like your own home expenditure. Would you spend money on this? And then you say, well, what's it going to cost me if I don't spend
money? And
what
do I get back?
So if I'm going to fix my house, I'm going to buy, what's it going to cost me? And what do I get back? Am I just shelling out money continuously for no good? Am I throwing good money after bad? So for public officials, that's a perfectly reasonable thing to do. So this rather technocratic approach and this economic way of doing things, count the costs, yeah. So you've just listed all the important ones.
Mm. But I think
most importantly,
can we start with the individual, then move on to society?
Yes.
So someone's diagnosed with a mental illness, they're prescribed medication. To get to that point, they had to go to a GP, maybe a psychiatrist, maybe a therapist, maybe someone else. That all adds up pretty quick. Medicare pays for some of it, but by no means all of it.
So in Australia, only government expenditure typically only covers about 70% of that cost. We are very high in the proportion that comes out of your own pocket, about 30%. And that's actually higher than many of the other countries we compare ourselves with.
I reckon therapy, it's less than 70%, isn't it?
So that's in total.
Yeah.
But
if you look at specifics, so therapy, the gap is usually pretty big.
So what's happened, particularly in the last 10 years and much accelerated in the last 5 years, for the sort of thing you're talking about, the common things that don't involve hospitals, that don't involve emergency departments, that don't involve the public sector where you don't pay directly out of your own, have gone up and up. So for that kind of thing you're talking about, you're down to less than 50% of the money coming from government and 50% coming out of your own pocket.
Yeah.
So is it a good spend? So the total government expenditure in that kind of area, particularly through the federal government, is about $11 billion currently, which is pretty small in the total health budget, which is now headed over well over $200 billion a year. So we don't get much of the government share of that into the sort of services you're talking about.
So a lot of people are diagnosed with a mental illness in adolescence, where I guess they would hope that the economic impact would not be borne by them, but perhaps by their family, by their parents, but also in their early 20s, where they might be, you know, the economic impact might fall more directly on them. You know, if you're, no one's earning a lot of money in their early 20s, if you're on two or three medications and you've been recommended to have therapy, that is going to be a fair chunk of your disposable income, isn't it?
Absolutely. And what we see in the mental health area, because this is confounded by the fact that people with mental health problems tend to be out of education and employment. So typically they have less money to spend.
Yes.
Guess what? They don't take medications that might help. They don't see people who might help. So it's one of the areas where the economic burden on the individual results in not going forward for care, not getting treated, or postponing treatment. And certainly preferentially, we provide treatment to those who can pay, who are older, who are wealthier, and in Australia are in those suburbs that generally are of higher socioeconomic status, even though the rates of mental health problems in those suburbs is lower. So we've got quite a skewed system of even where the government money ends up and certainly who's got the capacity to pay privately for those services.
So are there practical ways to lower the burden on individuals? There are, isn't there? And that's the government paying a bigger chunk of it.
That's why we in Australia champion Medicare along with meat pies, kangaroos and Holden cars. We have this idea, we got this best equitable system in the world because we all believe that if you get run over in the street, it shouldn't matter whether you can pay, you should be able to get an ambulance, go to a hospital. If you get cancer, you should be able to go to a hospital and get treated. And we have this belief in the equity of it and it should be available to help people literally get back on their feet. And particularly given that most mental health problems have their onset in young people, if you want to save young people and reduce the total lifetime cost, you'd intervene early. But you have just correctly highlighted that they are the people with least access to the system and least access to pay for the best treatment in those systems. So we think, generally speaking, we say as Australians, right, Medicare should be there or government support should be there in whatever form we call it. We just put it all under the brand of Medicare. We don't care whether it's a public hospital or government reimbursement or who. And we believe that that's the case. Now, in that sense, we have been gross underspenders in Australia on the gap between the population need to have this stuff, who really would benefit, particularly young people, and what we currently spend. Now, we're not Robinson Crusoe on that. That's true worldwide. People have not built health systems relative to the size of the problem out there in the community. So a lot of this argument goes, we actually underspend. Now, that doesn't mean necessarily that you just throw more money at it the way that it is. So issues about who gets what, what's the focus, where's the best return on investment? You love that economic talk. Return on investment. For the dollar you spend, which one's going to get you $5 back? Which one's going to get you $10 back?
But also importantly, when you talk about return on investment, what you're really talking about is if you spend $10, how are you going to spend that money most effectively to lower the rate of mental illness in the community and improve people's mental health? Because that does two things. It reduces human suffering, which is what we want, and it also gives the government bang for its buck.
And governments also fairly want to spend it efficiently.
Yeah, of course.
If you could have paid $5 to get the same response, why did you pay $25? So that's other. It's an efficiency kind of issue. How is it done?
Well, and it's not government's money; it's our money.
So it's all of our money. So we expect public officials to do that.
Yeah.
We also expect them to do it with equity. Now we expect them to do them with a bit of common sense. What would financial investors do? Since we're talking dollars and finance,
yeah.
Would you put something in that's going to return a lot more for the same $5 than if you put it into a different way of doing things? Now, that's why the issues around, I'm glad you started with teenagers, the real costs of mental health problems are accumulated over a lifetime. The longer you leave the problem, the more likely a young person is not to finish school, not to go on to post-school education, not to go on to post-school employment, therefore not to pay tax into those systems and be more dependent on the social welfare systems, not just in health but in social services and in housing and in everything else. So the biggest return on investment is actually through earlier intervention. Now, you just raised the catch-22. That means teenagers, young people who have the least capacity to pay for the best interventions.
So an analogy is cancer. If you can diagnose it really early, you can treat it effectively. You can treat it, I mean, you know, not all the time, but often. You can have a high chance of it going into remission for a long time, perhaps for a lifetime, and you can get back out and back to work, earning money to pay tax on, possibly in a short period, in a few months. If you get it late, you're going to be in hospital for a while. There's going to be lots of expensive machines going beep, beep, beep. There's going to be operations, and the odds of you ever paying tax again become lower. So the earlier you get anything,
and a lot of people take care of you. You just made a really critical point. With those early interventions and all those other areas, it's so straightforward, and people do return to work. Even if the cancer comes back 10 years later, they've often returned to work. They've been very productive. They've paid tax, and they've only required care for a short period of time, and other people have not had to care for them. Mm. Once you've got a really developed illness, other people, families, have to take time off work. You spend a lot of time going to doctors. Everyone's productivity goes down because the time and cost of healthcare goes up. You wouldn't believe in the mental health area, we still have these quite academic arguments about the value or not of early intervention. But reducing the disability and costs, as distinct from changing the complete course of the illness, still gets argued about. Mm. Whereas I would suggest that common rational man like yourself, James, just articulated very expertly why we should be doing it and hence why we should invest in it.
Well, yes, in a theoretical way, but you'd have to have the numbers that back that up, which you probably
don't. The numbers. Mm. So I was in a great meeting yesterday and people talked about the qualitative, like the human experience of many of these things, and that's kind of why we do it, because human experience adds up. And I said, yeah, but what about the quantitative? why don't we turn that into numbers and then multiply it up? Because I got to go talk to finance. I got to go talk to Treasury. Mm. When Julia Gillard was the Prime Minister, she made a great set of announcements, public speech after the 2012 budget about why they were investing more in early intervention in teenagers in Australia, which gave rise to a lot of the additional expenditure under Headspace. And she said on the cabinet table, there's lots of arguments as to all the people in need. But, you know, in order to decide between them, you need to know two things. You need to know whether you're going to spend money on works and you need to know the value of it. Mm. You need to be able to argue that this investment, this is better than submarines, this is better than some other form of housing, this is better than some other, you know, thing we might spend money on from a financial point of view as well as from a human point of view.
Yeah.
And you can scale it up. You can show the size of it.
Yeah. Talking about numbers, the Productivity Commission said direct expenditure on mental health care and support services was around $16 billion. That's by governments. But the annual cost of lower economic participation and lost productivity was 39, and the cost of replacing the support provided by carers was 15. So that's 54. So I think what you're saying is if you raise the 16 a bit and spend it more efficiently, then the $54 billion lost from lost productivity, which is a very dry economic term, but what it means is people being too sick to go to work or people caring for those who are too mentally ill to go to work. If you raise the $16 billion, that $54 billion from lost productivity will come down more than you raise the $16 billion. Is that it?
Correct.
Yeah.
If, just a big if.
If you do it efficiently.
If you do it efficiently, you think about it. So when I was on the National Mental Health Commission and the Abbott government got elected, for those who are old enough to remember, there was a review. Actually, Peter Dutton was the health minister. Just imagine there is no more money. Okay, now I'd say right up the front, we need to spend more money on mental health. Okay. But just imagine there's no more money.
Right.
Think first,
there's no more money.
Just imagine there's no more money in the post-COVID world. Just imagine there's no more money. Think about, are we spending it most efficiently? Because if you pour a lot of new money into the existing system, you'll get more of it. Now, does it actually have this early intervention focus? Does it hit those who are most likely to return that productivity? Now, for example, going back to your cancer analogy, if you spend all of the money on people with terminal cancer, you might do that from a human point of view, make their lives fabulously good for the last 6 months of their life. You wouldn't see much return on that investment. We're not expecting those people to go back and pay tax. If by contrast, you said exactly what you said, what we've done in the cancer area, we put a lot of effort on early detection and early effective treatment.
Breast cancer, bowel cancer, sending out tests to people over 50.
Yes, if you've received one of those things in the mail that people like myself receive every year.
Basically, if you're under 50, when you get to 50, they'll send you a little, they'll send you something in the mail.
And the poo pack.
They want you to put a bit of poo in it and send it back, and you do, and then they tell you whether you need to get a colonoscopy or not. A friend of mine just did that and had a they said you need to have a colonoscopy, and he was scared shitless. and he had it and he was fine.
Right.
But he was in the most high risk for screening, so they screened him and said he was fine.
So we do this in bowel cancer, people in breast cancer. We've had mammogram in the past, all sorts of things. And lung, people have been smokers.
Skin cancer. Having annual checkups.
Because we all know in those areas, if you detect early and treat early, not only might you, for a significant number, and hopefully you do, prevent it going on to something bad, but those people then immediately go back to work. The great majority continue to pay tax.
Yeah.
And hopefully you – this is
and live a long time.
Well, they live a long time as taxpayers.
Yeah.
Get this? This is terrible. I'm sorry. And I apologize continuously. But this is the financial bit, okay? This is productive lives, meaning they're paying tax into the system. So the cost that you've spent on their healthcare is a very small part of what
they've paid of tax.
All the tax they paid. And that's what we expect out of our taxes. Mm. That's why we all think taxation is a good idea up to a point.
Yeah.
Because it comes back and helps us get these essential services.
Of course, the fact that it works on cancer doesn't in itself mean that it works in mental health.
Right.
But you would say, do you, that you have the evidence that early intervention is efficient. Is that right?
Yes. Hmm. So on the balance of all the things that can be done, and one of the things that's most important, and why I make this differentiation, is in this economic argument, it's not about whether it simply cures the mental health problem.
Yep.
Or prevents it progressing to some degree. It's the reduction in disability. It's the kids who get care go to school. Kids who get care go to university, go into the trades. Adults who get early continue to work. So the participation bit, rather than just whether it reduces their symptoms or make the thing go away, which is a separate argument, is the effect on disability, or if you like, or costs, is dramatic. And if you focus on that. That a lot of the point here, and why in completely separate episodes, James, we've addressed the issue of not just treat the symptoms, but get the person back to work, back to school.
Yeah.
The focus of the intervention.
And I would imagine, you know, for this dry economic language, get them back towards paying tax, actually doing those things, there would be a strong correlation with reducing human suffering too. If you're not able to go back to work because you're too mentally unwell, you are probably suffering much more greatly than someone who is able to go back to work.
Yes. So to skip the economics, as I often say and then get beaten with a stick for saying it, we don't get well to go to work. We go to work to get well. We actually need to work and participate to have mental health. And we've had a lot of research on the fact that – sounds terrible, doesn't it? getting people back to school or work is very therapeutic.
Yeah.
Makes symptoms go down, improves our mental health, essential to our sleep-wake cycles, essential to the way we act in the world. So it's actually very therapeutic.
Yeah.
So win-win. It's good for your mental health and it's good for the national economy to do it. So you would think, as Julie Gillard said in 2012, of the new money we're going to spend, we're going to proportionally increase the amount around early intervention for teenagers, because that's where we have the best evidence of the return on investment plus the reduction in this disability. Now, there's a lot of arguments, you know, because this gets tricky in the health area, because everyone says, well, what if I'm a child? What if I'm a 70-year-old? Don't I have an equal right to good care? And you say, yeah, like from a human rights point of view, I get it. Everyone should get the best care that they should. But the economic argument is, hang on, as we also spend money, what's going to deliver the greatest value to all of us? Because all of us are paying for it.
But also we're not in a situation where we have to decide whether a 16-year-old or a 70-year-old can receive treatment. Both can receive treatment. Anyone can go to a GP. They can get prescribed medication. They can get referred to a good therapist. And they're the two things that the evidence
tells. Hang on there.
Yeah.
That anyone isn't true.
Well, it is the in cost theory.
Of getting, well, in theory, James, you're obviously of an age like myself. No. Where you think Medicare functions in that way?
No, but I guess what I'm saying is Medicare is set up to function like that. And anyone can get medication, right? There aren't any bottlenecks are there in getting prescribed antidepressants and then go to a pharmacy.
Yes, there are.
Are there?
Yes. Let's go. The cost of going to a GP, the cost of buying a medicine, who's subsidised? And there's also medicines that are not on the PBS that people who've got money can purchase, right, that people who haven't got money can purchase. There are all sorts of inequities baked in, including who GPs see. They love middle-aged people like us. I mean, we're great GP patients. You know, part of the origin of Headspace in Australia was the fact that we demonstrated back in the 1990s, young people did not get in to see GPs. The 1990s, when bulk billing was much higher, didn't get in, didn't get their mental health problem addressed. And this is what gave rise to an innovation, Headspace, to create an alternative system. But to do that costs a lot of money to set up a new system. Now, John Howard, of all people,
but it's there,
bought that argument. Well, it is now.
Yeah.
Right. So the economics here matter. If people think the economics is just some ridiculous discussion going on in the background here, these things matter to decision making, demonstrating that they – so, for example, the government could have just poured more money back in 2004 into the existing GP system. It would not have assisted a great deal, a lot of young people. Hence, the decision was made to set up Headspace, in fact, which started then in 2007. That was a new federal government expenditure. And the argument at the time was not simply we should take care of young people. Mm. It was based around this will be good economics. So credit to the Howard government, then extended by the Gillard government to go, you know, this makes sense. You know that thing called the Expenditure Review Committee sits around there in Canberra wiping out good ideas every budget. There are lots of good ideas in lots of departments. But the economist people, the Expenditure Review Committee, Finance, Treasury, come on, go, nah, waste of time.
Okay, but Headspace, well, it's now been going 2007, 17 years.
Yes.
Has it had the beneficial effects that were hoped for?
It met its first goal, get young people in the door.
Yeah.
The second set of goals and the third set of goals, make sure they get good care and make sure they recover. It has struggled. It's struggling because it needs further investment. It needs systems to develop preferentially to spend the money that we have in smart ways so that more of those services, more specialist services still go to older people like myself and yourself and those who have more financial resources and those who live in our cities who in fact have less need or there's less return. I hate to say this, James. There's less return on investment in spending money on us.
Yeah.
Lifetime.
Yeah. But also, I mean,
in the mental health world.
Yeah. I mean, no one is.
Now, we shouldn't stop taking care of you.
Let's be clear. I mean, no one has denied medical treatment for cancer when they're 86, are they?
If they get into the system.
Well, yeah.
You're making a lot of assumptions. 86-year-olds with cancers do get into the system. And if you turn up at your public hospital, there will be a treatment for you. No one will turn around and say you're not having a treatment because you're 86.
Yeah.
In fact, when I was a young doctor, whoa, was that a long time ago, and I'm very sensitive about this now, I worked in a hospital in Western Sydney where they introduced a rule that if you were over 65, and let's say I'm very sensitive about that age this year, if you're over 65 and you had a heart problem, you had to go to the geriatric ward, not the heart ward. Now, right. I'm very sensitive about that age this year.
Yeah, right.
Now, let's say the specialist care in the geriatric ward for heart problems was not the same as the specialist care in the heart ward by age. On the basis of that time, it was thought that 65-year-olds were barely worth the investment and we should do the other. Mm-hmm. Now, that lasted about 10 minutes. Because people went, hang on a second, down the corridor, there's real treatment. Up here, I'm being parked without the treatment.
Yeah.
Now, that didn't last because the uproar in our public hospital system. So there was kind of some of this thinking behind that, but it didn't last on an equity human rights basis.
Yeah.
Now, in the mental health area, I'm afraid to say it's not the case. You can go to a public hospital any day you like as a young person and not get effective mental health care.
Because?
It's not there.
Well, there's...
There's an emergency department.
Yeah, and there's psychiatrists there.
And your chance of getting significant assessment and ongoing care if you're a young person who turns up not in absolute crisis, just over the weekend. Do I sound a bit worked up about this?
A little.
Good. Just over the weekend, you know, recommendation, someone in crisis took their kid to an emergency department. And of course, like many others, they left before anyone saw them after being there 6 hours and then being told by the triage nurse, look, frankly... There's a lot of other important things here, car crashes, heart attacks, whatever else. You're going to get sent home anyway. We're not actually going to help because we're not set up to help. It's not really the right place with the assumption that there's somewhere down the road on Monday that you will get help. Not happening. It's not there. We haven't built those systems. So what I'm arguing constantly is the investment in new systems that would be good value with targets. Children, young people, early intervention, that would return not only the social cost, families,
but when you say systems, I mean, headspace is there. What else do they need to work effectively?
Clinicians, specialist services, psychologists, psychiatrists.
Yeah.
You think you go there. How many psychiatrists do you think are there? How many doctors do you think are there?
No idea.
No idea. You go to the big hospital.
How many?
In some cases, none.
Right.
In some cases, one. In some cases, perhaps in 12 weeks, you'll get to see one. Mm. You'll get to see a youth worker. You'll get to see someone who does an assessment at the least. But in terms of someone who can provide effective care to get you back to work. Now, we published a very important paper, my research group, just a few years ago, which caused a good deal of controversy that Headspace was not delivering the return to education and employment that is essential to this economic argument. Not because Headspace is not a good idea. Headspace is a great idea. Fabulous front door. Because now people can get in. But when you get there, does it do effectively the job? And it's free. So the other issue that's important about a Headspace is publicly funded and the services there are free.
So if you go to Headspace and someone assesses you and it's clear that there should be a medical intervention, that you might need to be on antidepressants, the person
someone's going to be able to make that assessment.
Well, yeah, okay. But you said there are youth workers there who can make an assessment. They can make they can't say this person needs to be on antidepressants. They can say, I think this person needs to be on antidepressants, so they need to see a GP.
They might not even say that. They may know very little about antidepressants and who benefits. They can
surely
say,
if you're a youth worker at Headspace, you know a bit about antidepressants.
No.
No?
You don't.
Like it's a mental health facility. Yeah. How can you work in a mental health facility and not know about antidepressants?
That depends on the training of the people you see.
Right, but surely they don't employ people who aren't trained.
To that degree?
Well, they know about antidepressants. That's not a very high degree.
You are a very highly educated person, James, by your TRIM system.
It doesn't.
So the original model.
You don't have to be highly educated to know that antidepressants are a treatment for mental illness.
Well, yeah, but who needs to be referred to know that, right? So what they're saying is people in crisis, people come along and tell all sorts of stories as to why they're there, bullying, breakup in a relationship, school stuff, trouble with housing, whatever else. The assessment process often is around a crisis, okay?
Yeah.
What needs to be done to keep the young person safe? And then often the next step is, okay, depending on the complexity and the story, you need to see someone who needs to be able to weigh up the relative value of medications versus psychological therapies, what's most appropriate. Guess what? That's fairly skilled.
Well, that's a GP.
So
GPs do that every day.
That's one.
Every day. And anyone, well, not anyone, but most people in most parts of Australia can get in to see a GP today.
Most young, we demonstrate that.
Most people can.
James, this is where you got to look at the data. From the 1990s onwards, we've demonstrated that's not true for a whole lot of young people, and a whole lot of young people now with the cost up front.
No, there's a difference between I don't want to see a GP and I am trying to see a GP, but it is impossible. What I'm saying is most people, if they want to see a GP today, could.
James,
is that not true?
No, it's not true. I've had daughters live in this ACT, your favourite place, over the last 20 years, and most of them have had to drive back to Sydney to see a GP or to get care. Well, in the ACT, if you weren't born there and you weren't checked in and you aren't registered with one of those general practices, you try getting in. 20,000 students have just turned up there in the start of this year from all over the country. They ain't got GPs and they're not getting to see GPs.
Right.
Come back in 3 months. You know,
to see a GP.
To see a GP in the Australian Capital Territory. To see a GP in Western Sydney. And with the increasing decline in bulk billing and have $50 or $30 or $70 when you turn up, when you see you. So in the youth area, which is the area we've discussed with greatest investment, it is the hardest. For middle-aged people who've established a relationship with GPs or have and can pay and are increasingly paying more, why do you think for Minister Butler, this is his biggest issue out of the last budget, was pouring billions of dollars more into trying to make the cost of seeing a GP not so high? Or the second bit, the cost of buying a medicine. So going back one step, your average headspace, anyone else is going to say, look, you need to see a clinical psychologist or a psychiatrist who can make that assessment or a GP. The original headspace model, back to John Howard, was going to have a GP in each of those headspaces and a clinical psychologist and a psychiatrist working together in those places. So behind the front door of headspace would be the skill set to see the right people. And the proportion of young people who came in who needed would get assessed and will get access to that. It's not the case. So unlike your hospital, where if you can get through the emergency department triage thing and you don't leave before you see anyone, there will be at least a psychiatrist in training, a psychiatry registrar or a mental health nurse, someone of considerably higher skill level, which is why a lot of parents and young people end up at emergency departments. In fact, in research we've published, we've demonstrated the extent to which people who are using Headspace are also, guess what, going to emergency departments. Now, that just tells you the system isn't really working. Now, I would say funded and organised to provide what you would expect in cancer care or in heart care through our combination of public and private, our hybrid system in Australia.
Yeah. So that is part of the $54 billion the Productivity Commission estimated as lost productivity for people, lost productivity for carers of people who have mental illness. The 16, we're talking about the government expenditure, which made up $16 billion of the expenditure, total $70 billion. So if you increase the $16 billion to 18 or 20 in the hope of bringing down the $54 billion lost, how would you do it? It sounds like you're going to say fund Headspace properly, but then the problem is there's a bottleneck and there's not enough probably psychologists and definitely not enough psychiatrists to put them in everyone.
Good. Now we're into detailing the sets of structural problems.
Yes.
So of that $16 billion, it's split about half-half between the Commonwealth and the states in total at the time the report was done. Now, the state end is very much on hospitals, emergency departments, acute care teams, right? What you might call the tough end, the emergency end, and is a relatively kind of fixed cost.
Yep.
You can't, and I'm not suggesting, just to be clear here, ever shutting down public hospitals or emergency departments or mental health wards in public hospitals, etc. They're a necessary part, but they're expensive. The other part is spent by the Commonwealth. About half of it is spent by the Commonwealth on things like Medicare and Medicare rebates for psychologists and psychiatrists. It's a pretty small proportion of that. Now, we did some modelling recently is that, okay, if you started increasing that, if you poured amount of monies into that, that seven you were talking about, well, half of that would need to go to about $22
billion. Right, from 16, yep.
In the current system to start to reach the sort of people we're talking about.
Right.
If you remodeled
that. And how would you do
it? Well, just to I'll tell you something. If you remodeled that and didn't do it that way, for about $14 billion,
you get the same result. Spending now.
Right. So you're sitting there in cabin, okay, so let's say seven. You can spend 14 or 22.
14, please.
To get the same result.
Yeah.
Say 14. Okay, the only trouble with the 14 is you're going to have to reform the system.
So you're going to have to knock it down and build it again.
Well, you're going to have to try and refloat the Titanic while it's sinking, yes. You're going to have to kind of
itself wouldn't be free.
No. No, no, no. But what you're doing is you'd start to introduce these kind of things that we have talked about. So the earlier intervention kind of focus, the headspace type things, not just pour into existing.
No, but they're there.
Practice. No, but you've got to expand it and then fill in the back end. So in the headspace, when you go there,
being,
there's psychiatrists and psychologists and GPs actually there. You have to pay the staff.
Yeah.
But someone has to pay those staff.
You also have to solve the bottleneck problem in that there aren't enough psychiatrists and psychologists.
So what they do – okay, so – let's take that. We've done work in the headspace setting that says if you use the right, and here's my favorite thing, of course, smart triage systems. You use technology to work out who. See, in the current system, there's take a ticket, right? Take a ticket, you wait, and then there's the bottleneck. You're not sorting out, you know. Now, you don't want all of those people to have to see a psychiatrist, not all the people who go. So we've done work in that area. About 20% of those people who present need to see someone more skilled, clinical psychologist or psychiatrist. Okay. And about half of those, about 10%, really need ongoing care by those groups. So smart triage systems, use of technology, escalating those who need to see the specialist services is the issue, not just pouring more people in there. Mm. The smart use of the people. On the other end of the spectrum, those who could more effectively self-manage, use new technologies or use coaches or use other people, don't really need to see a psychologist or a psychiatrist, but do need to monitor their mental health. They have had a crisis. There's something going on, and follow them and track them. So smarter technology, better organization, not just letting things rip as they are, has the capacity to produce more efficient systems. Now, in Australia, we don't like that kind of thing. Every profession argues for more of me.
Mm.
More nurses, more psychologists, more psychiatrists, more GPs, and pay us more, and then somehow we'll coordinate the whole thing. Guess what? We don't. And we also all want to be paid more, so we're being paid more by the government, and many people where they can are charging more out of pocket as well to see me. So the demand for mental health services, the community wants more. On the government side, you've got to be thinking, hang on, what's the efficient way of doing that? What's the modern way? Now, Headspace goes back to advocacy in 2004, establishment in 2007. What do we do in 2024? Now we've got technology, we've got other possibilities. And we know these things. So the coordination of care and the personalization of care so that people, the right people get the right care. Not everyone just queues up in a non-specific way.
Yeah.
So smarter investments. Now, do you think we do that? No.
Well, put it this way. If you present an emergency with a mental health crisis and you see a psychiatrist and you've been seeing another psychiatrist for months and you have a long history of mental health, it's pretty likely that the psychiatrist you see will know none of that and you'll have to tell them as
best
you can.
Start all over again.
Yeah.
Oh, and I have experience
when
on the weekend.
Records of it everywhere.
And worse, experiences again over the weekend. I do sound a bit worked up about this, don't I? If that person even fails to ring or contact the other person to even try to find out.
But shouldn't that all be there? What's that, you know, MyGovHealth or whatever? Shouldn't it all be there on a document in front of them? Shouldn't they have access to it? Why, I mean,
so we've been arguing about these systems of access for about 15 years.
Yeah.
Have we, those systems work? Are they in place? No. That data's not available.
But how? I mean, any
how
competent organisation these days, you would just say, I need to find out about this. I'll just bring it up on
how
my
many organisations? If you got an emergency department, how many organisations do you think are involved? The emergency department of that hospital talks to that hospital. The psychiatrist you saw is down the road, completely disconnected from that. Their GP is probably disconnected from both.
Yeah. But doesn't the patient have a central medical record that
– no. Only if you're part of the MyGov type approach to that. No.
Aren't most people?
No. In fact, the greatest group as told to me – let me say – I am an advocate for those things, okay?
Yeah, me
and
too.
And back when Greg Hunt was the minister and this was being pushed forward, and I was one of the people saying, look, we in mental health have to be in this. Yeah. I went home and discussed it with my own kids because I got on TV saying that, and they went, ha, we've just opted out. We don't trust the government. And those systems are not ones that we can alter. And my mental health kind of records, they're not accurate. What's been put in by you guys is often not accurate in those systems. And I'm not confident
that it won't be hacked.
Not that it won't be hacked, that system won't be used appropriately. I don't trust those systems because they're not They're systems between the professionals, those ones. They're not ones that involve the patient at all.
What if I want to work for ASIO and they say, oh, look, 18 years ago you had a
So people worry for insurance, they worry for employment, they worry for all issues around mental health that you might imagine.
Okay, well, look, we're just about out of time on this episode. So you've described a better system of early intervention and more resources being pumped into that would have, you say, a big return on investment and cost less than the current system. Is it likely that there will be any steps made toward that?
It's the journey that we're on.
It's not a yes or a no, is it?
Well, my kids do say, oh, Dad, you've been saying the same thing for 30 years. Yeah. Where's the progress? The community progress is significant. But I think what I'm also saying and saying to a lot of people working in this area, don't just ask for more. Ask for better.
Yes.
Ask for better. Mm. And when you talk about public expenditure, you've got to be looking at, okay, not just the human cost, which – and I must say, when Helen Coonan was the assistant treasurer back in the Conservative government 20 years ago, and I've been rabbiting on for this for some time, she said at the point, Ian, at some point can we stop talking about the money and go back to talking about the people?
Oh, that's nice.
And I was great. And I said, yes, Helen, that's exactly true. That's fabulous. Only trouble is we're going to need government to make decisions about expenditure.
About the money.
To support those who are not able to do it and to do it efficiently.
Enough about Helen Coonan, though. What about Mark Butler and Katie Gallagher and Anthony Albanese? You're up there talking to them, advocating for this stuff all the time. Are there any signs that the reforms you're advocating may be nearer?
So Mark Butler is back in this gig after 10 years being away. He's certainly a strong advocate for this kind of stuff. But reform in the Australian healthcare system, Medicare reform, and the Labor Party has a problem, you know, Medicare, can't touch it, sacred cow, marvellous thing, bulk billing, just leaving it as
well,
a kind
of-
Well,
you can make it better. No one's saying don't make it better.
Well-
And adjustments are made to Medicare every day. They put new drugs on PBS
So on the
that.
Political side, there are two things. The one we've been discussing. On the political side, you've got to make the economic argument. You've got to make, and then the one at the moment is cost of living. So the government reduced the cost of buying pharmaceuticals in Australia because the number of Australians can no longer afford to buy pharmaceuticals. We pay a very high price over the counter in Australia for the drugs we use, and that stops people using them. So the government made some changes there. The government putting more money into bulk billing rates because the cost of seeing a doctor, particularly for older Australians like you and me, has got unaffordable for a lot of Australians. So we're up there competing with other priorities in that area, mental health and its importance. But we also have to be talking about doing it better, put more, and what the big economic investments will be. And I must say, I've highlighted three, I think, John Howard, Julia Gillard, Malcolm Turnbull, all bought that argument a lot. So we need the current government to step up in the same
way. When you say they, I mean, we should finish, but when you say they bought it a lot, they didn't implement the sort of system you're advocating, or bits of it.
Each of those people made significant investments of new money and some elements of reform, like the birth of Headspace or support for technology, or in Julia Gillard's case, significant additional investments into things like Headspace early intervention. They started that particular process. Julia Gillard, when she set up the National Commission, said, we've got to monitor this. These things often go off track.
Well, you've said it has gone off track.
Well, yes. So the political process is also continuing to supervise or oversee, is it really working? Now, I'd say at this point, in truth, and as Mark Butler says, in truth, a lot of things have gone off the rails. So the political –
Wouldn't it be good if you know, he was in a position of power to get him back on the rails? And he obviously is. I mean, who's in a better position to do it than a health minister?
A treasurer?
Right.
Prime minister? Going back to where we started. Right. Where do you think the real decisions get made?
Yeah.
Prime minister and cabinet, treasury, finance.
Right.
And I must say, if I can say, the current head of Treasury, Stephen Kennedy, great guy who used to be, guess what, before he was an economist?
Psychiatrist?
Nurse. A person, a people person at the head of Treasury.
There you go.
And he is totally on board with the same issue. We need to make investments. They need to be smart investments. They need to be substantial, not just throw money around everywhere on little things that don't work. But that requires structural reform, and that means the public ain't the problem, but I would suggest a lot of the professional groups are.
Right. But the government sits above them all.
On behalf of all of us.
Yeah. The government.
Write to your local member.
Can do it.
Write to Mr. Albanese. Write to Mr. Butler. Write to your local member and say, this really matters to me.
Got any questions or comments or want to suggest further topics for us to discuss? We get some great suggestions for topics and we do them all the time. Do get in touch. Send us an email at mindingyourmind2. That's mindingyourmind2@gmail.com. Our book, Minding Your Mind, is out, as is Ian's book about depression, The Devil You Knew. And our podcast is supported by the generous philanthropic donations from families who support ongoing research into youth mental health. Further help is available from Headspace, Beyond Blue, Head to Health, and Lifeline. Google them or you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14.